This is Frank Riccio in Talking About the Law. And we have the honor and pleasure, actually, to have Ken Levine, a very accomplished, skilled attorney in medical malpractice law and especially obstetrical law. We're going to change gears a little bit, and I know I cut off Ken when he raised the issue of brain injury, but brain injury cases are extremely serious cases. They're catastrophic cases, which take up an incredible toll on parents, both emotionally and financially. And so what I'm going to do is, Ken, could you explain to the audience what brain injury cases are all about?
Absolutely. And again, as you mentioned before, Frank, so much of this is common sense and very understandable by people who are not physicians. But doctors over the years have developed tools to be able to assess how well a baby is doing prior to delivery. And the most important tool is this fetal heart monitor strip. And what it tells us is, how well is the baby dealing with the insult, the difficulty of the delivery process, which can be tough on a baby. Now, some babies are healthy and strong, and during the contractions and pushing phase, they do very, very well. But some kids are not doing well. And when doctors look at the fetal heart monitor strips, they can actually see the mother's contraction, and they can see the baby's reaction to the contraction. And I can give you a quick example. It's like if I walked into a boxing gym tomorrow and I punched one of the boxes in the stomach as hard as I could and they brushed it off, I would know he's a strong guy. If I punched someone in the stomach hard and they doubled over and they were really struggling, I would think they were in trouble. That's the fetal heart monitor strip. The mother's contraction is the hit. The top of the form shows us the baby's reaction. Doctors have to be very, very aware of this because it tells them maybe the baby's not strong enough to handle the delivery process. Baby might be at risk for suffering a lack of oxygen. And as you said, kids that have brain damage at birth, who are vegetative, who have cerebral palsy, it's a lifelong, terrible, terrible effect.
What should the doctors do in terms of monitoring the strips? What should they look for? And what should they do if they see that the baby is in trouble?
Well, they've got to be careful. And when they see a baby that might be in what we would call fetal distress, a baby that might be suffering some distress, it's important to go to the mom and dad and say, you know, we've seen this strip, we've seen this information. We can't say for sure, but your baby might be at risk for a lack of oxygen. And the risk is so great. You know, it's always a balance of risk. So the risk is so great because if there's a lack of oxygen, your child could suffer brain damage. So even if it's not 100% likely or even 60 or 50, whatever percent likely, 20%, 10%. And if you're the mom and dad and a doctor came to you and said, you know, there's a 10% chance that your baby might be permanently brain damaged, we could offer you a cesarean section. That would be very important information for you to have and a decision that you as parents should make with the doctor.
In those situations where, for whatever reason, the doctors did not offer that to the parents or did not do a cesarean section, what are the outcomes?
Well, the reason, you know, it's funny. Malpractice cases, people sometimes think it's because of the doctors not being smart or whatever. Frank, you and I both know these doctors are smart as anything. Most of these birth injury malpractice cases come from an arrogance. It's like I call it the cowboy mentality, where the doctors have this attitude, you know, I'm not going to do cesarean sections today. You know, we're going to power through. And that's just not the right way to go. You've got to consider the parents, and mostly you've got to consider the baby. The way I look at it, people ask me all the time, how can you tell if a doctor was below the standard of care, was negligent? I give people the same rule. Did the doctor treat the mom and the baby as he would if it was his daughter, if it was his sister? You know, what I'm looking for in these cases are the chance the doctor took by not having the mom have the option of cesarean section, would he have taken that chance with his own daughter, his own child, his own wife, his own baby? If the answer is no, then the doctor fell below the standard of care.
Well, you know, you raise a good point because the British Medical Journal several years actually did a study, and what they did is they actually quizzed female OBGYNs from England, and most of them elected elected. This is not even a baby in distress. They said that they would do an elective cesarean section. And, you know, a good part of that is birth is rough.
Right.
And, you know, one of the reasons we know that they have fetal strips is to kind of give the warning that something is going on. Now, what is the nature of the injury? I mean, you know, if the doctor doesn't intervene and the baby is lacking oxygen, so-called hypoxia, what is the nature of the injury?
Well, it's we get oxygen by several ways. We as adults, we breathe in air. The oxygen goes into our lungs. It transfers the membrane of our lung to the blood system, so our blood system can work through our heart and give us what we need to live. Babies get that supply of oxygen through the umbilical cord because they're not breathing yet in the uterus as they deliver. So if there's a lack of oxygen issue with the babies, they will unfortunately suffer. The body protects itself from the outside in. So cerebral palsy kids, you'll see sometimes who have some cognitive brain function, but their limbs and their arms and they have trouble. And then you have some kids who are so brain damaged, their brain has been affected by the lack of oxygen, that they are born almost vegetative. They have no cognitive brain function. They have no physical movement. It's it's a horrible, horrible thing, not only obviously for the baby who's brain damaged, but when you meet, as you have, as I have, you know, you meet a young family come in, young kids in their 20s, and now they have this child who suffered permanent brain damage. Life is never going to be the same.
And my experience, and I'm sure yours has been the same, is I am amazed at how dedicated these parents are to these children. They don't want them institutionalized.
Absolutely right. Absolutely don't. Yeah, that's true.
They bring these kids up as teenagers, you know, they do a remarkable job. I mean, I've gone to their homes, and the children are well cared for, clean, and everything else.
But back to the issue you mentioned before, the cost issue is really important in this situation because, you know, if the physicians aren't held responsible for the medical errors that cause these kids to need lifelong care, and you know how expensive it can be to care for a child who's suffered permanent brain damage, you know, if the medical malpractice insurance companies are not responsible for this cost, then the general public is, because the health insurance companies are going to pay, or if they don't have health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, we all are going to pay. So it's important that if physicians make a mistake that caused this to happen, that they are responsible and responsible financially to take the burden off of the health insurance system and the federal government.
And in terms of, you raise some great issues in terms of public policy, because one of the purposes of insurance is to cover against a risk. And right. So, you know, it's not an unfair distribution of money. What it actually is it's a fair distribution, because the malpractice insurance companies are getting premiums for their coverage. So if one of these catastrophic cases do happen, they're able to spread the risk amongst the carrier. If there is fault.
If there is fault. But, Frank, you know this to be true, too, and this is one of the – well, we could go on – you and I could go on about this for a long time, but just to go to one small area, too. We have a board of registration in medicine in Massachusetts that is supposed to monitor doctors and monitor doctors' activities. Years ago, it was a much more aggressive board. They did a much better job of trying to weed out bad doctors. They are not very aggressive right now, and they do very little to weed out the bad doctors. And you and I both know that there are 80%, not 85% of the OBGYNs who have never been sued. And then that 15% that have been sued 3 or 4 or 5 times each. And yes, their malpractice rates are very, very high, as they should be, because these are people that have shown they have some problems. But there's no check and balance. Other than the only check and balance are the lawyers that investigate the cases, that bring the cases, and that maybe their insurance becomes so expensive they can't continue to practice anymore and these bad doctors can get out of the system. But there's no other way to get them out of the system right now.
Now, are brain injury cases less costly to bring?
Oh, no, we're
less time consuming and less difficult to bring.
The brachial plexus cases are one thing. The brain damage different cases are a whole other ball game. Now, in those cases, the kind of experts that we would look at are, first off, OBGYN. Secondly, something called a maternal fetal medicine specialist, who's a kind of a secondary specialist in delivering babies. Sometimes we look at people who are perinatologists, who are specialists in the baby's well-being while in the uterus, pediatric neurologists. But also, too, we need people who do what we refer to as a life care plan, and vocational experts, economic experts, because one of the things we're looking at is just how expensive is it going to be to care for a brain-damaged child over a lifetime? And we need to know what that cost is. So there's a whole nother range of, I mean, the kids who have brachial plexus injury, hey, we hope they'll go to college. We hope they'll still have jobs and have working life. But the kids with brain damage who will not have a working life, we need to know who's going to care for them, how much will it cost. So there's a whole other layer of experts in those cases.
And I know you mentioned a cerebral palsy. Is every cerebral palsy case due to negligence?
No, absolutely not. And again, in the same way, you know, we look at a lot of cases with brain-damaged children and we turn down the majority of them because we can't find an error that the doctors have made. And sometimes there is a bad medical result and it's just no one's fault at all. It's just one of those things. But, you know, in cases where we can find the error, you know, we pursue the case. In the cases where we cannot, and again, that's the majority of the cases, we bring the families in, we sit with the nurses, we explain to them why we don't think there's a case.
And who typically bears that cost, that whole screening process?
That's that my firm, we bear the cost. That, you know, once the person comes in and we begin to get the records, and if we've referred the case out to medical experts who have not agreed with us, forcing us to turn the case down, all that cost, which could be several thousand dollars, we bear. We do not ask the parents for that money. We know they need that money for their children.
So there's really no incentive for you to take on a case that has no potential merit.
No. You know, people talk about lawyers and how lawyers affect cases. You know, I tell people that, yes, the lawyer is important. We can find the right experts. We can work with the right nurses. We can hopefully try the case and present the information to a jury in a clear, in a convincing way. But in reality, facts make medical malpractice cases, not lawyers.
Hold that thought. We'll be back. This is Talking About the Law, and I'm Frank Riccione.